It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Sally Swift, in this week for Lynn Rosetto Casper, a superstar magazine editor, a best-selling author, and overnight unemployed. That is exactly the scenario Ruth Reichel faced when Gourmet shuttered in 2009.
The magazine closed, and I was in a really bad way. I mean, Gourmet magazine was almost 70 years old. It closed on my watch. 60 people lost their jobs, and it was like losing your family. I never saw it coming. And the reality hit me. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? I'm 62 years old. I don't have a job. Who's going to hire me? And who am I? I mean, I'd had a day job for my whole adult life. I felt guilty and depressed. And I did what I always do when I'm sad, lonely. I started cooking.
Ruth Reichel's Accidental Cookbook and Emeril Lagasse's Essential Recipes. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Sally Swift, in for Lynn Rosetto Casper this week. Gourmet magazine was unceremoniously shuttered in 2009, and no one was more surprised than its editor-in-chief, Ruth Reichel. That was the start of a very rough period for a woman with a very public persona. Surprisingly, what emerged from that time was a cookbook. Her first in 40 years, and it was entirely an accident. Ruth sat down with our contributor, Frances Lam, in New York City to talk about that year.
So, Ruth, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
And I know, you know, you're embarking on a book tour for a book in which you wrote about a book tour, so this is very meta, and I feel very honored to be in your meta universe. But let's talk a little bit about the book. You know, people love you for your stories, and I'm sure many, many people are eagerly anticipating your next memoir about the gourmet years. So why write a cookbook?
This was really accidental. I did not set out to write this book. And, you know, when the magazine closed and I was in a really bad way. I mean, Gourmet magazine was almost 70 years old. It closed on my watch. 60 people lost their jobs, and it was like losing your family. It was like losing an entire family overnight. I never saw it coming. And I was on book tour, and so that kept me busy for a while. It was odd because it was a tour for the Gourmet Cookbook, which I didn't get a penny for. It wasn't my book, but I was contractually obligated to do it. And it kept me busy for 6 weeks, and then I came home, and the reality hit me. Oh, my God, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? I'm 62 years old. I don't have a job. Who's going to hire me? And who am I? I mean, I'd had a day job for my whole adult life. And I felt guilty and depressed. And I did what I always do when I'm sad, lonely. I started cooking. And it was almost unconscious. It was just, it's my happy place. Mm-hmm. And it was about 8 months later. It was one of those gourmet reunions where we would all just sort of gather and hug each other and talk about who was doing what. And Bill Sertl turned to me and said, you know, you're always talking about how you wish people would go back into the kitchen. And maybe you were meant to write a book about this year. And it was like a light bulb went off over my head. Oh. And I felt like I had something to say to people. A few things. And one of them is cooking, when you give yourself to it, is a kind of wonderful healing meditation. Two, it is really important to pay attention to the little things in life. That, I mean, I came from this very big life with, you know, I mean, being an editor at Condé Nast is a very princess position. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there I was in the kitchen, and I loved it. And this was cooking just for the pure pleasure of it and seeing where it ended up. And that there's real value in doing that. Mm. Sorry, this was an endlessly long answer. I didn't mean to talk for 20 minutes.
No, this is great. But, you know, there's this really lovely, a really striking moment in the book, actually, where you're really upset. And the thing you remember to do or the thing you think to do is to make these dumplings that you'd learned to make in China. And they're very, the recipe sounds great and I would love to make them, but it sounds tricky. You have to make a wrapper out of a thin sheet of basically like a very, very like paper thin omelet. And then you make the wrapper out of that and you cook it while it's like already cooked and this whole thing. And you write in the book that it was meditative because it forced you to have to focus on that thing. And I thought that was so interesting because when I cook, and if I'm making something that requires precision and requires that kind of focus, I get really upset. And I realize, oh, for me, I think we all talk about, oh, the love of cooking and the love of working with food and putting your hands in the food and cooking for people. But for me, and I suspect for a lot of people, cooking is a performance.
Can I tell you that here's the difference between you and me. You are a trained cook. You're a chef.
No, but
but you went to culinary school, right? I mean,
sure.
You cook differently than I. I mean, I'm a home cook. I've never been trained in any way. I've never taken a cooking class except from home cooks. I don't have great knife skills, so I feel like every time I cook, I'm learning. And part of what I want the book to be about is give yourself permission to make mistakes, to try things you've never tried before. You know, stop thinking that you have to be a chef in your own kitchen.
I think that's so interesting because I feel like younger cooks who are like getting into cooking because they were into food, you know, there's this
right.
wave now of young foodies or whatever. They were psyched about chefs or psyched about restaurants. And now they take that same mentality and interest in food into their own home kitchen. And I feel like it's the mentality of someone who's been weaned on chef food now feels like it needs to be perfect when they make it at home.
I feel like we in the media have a lot to answer for because you don't have to be so result oriented, and you're really depriving yourself of, for me, the pleasure of cooking.
Yeah. And it's funny though, I feel like, you know, so we in the media have a lot to answer for. I'm sure that's, I agree. And I think a lot of it is because cooking and food are in what we call the lifestyle space in media, right? So it's about, oh, what is this fabulous life you can aspire to? And it's funny because I think, you know, you have had an active Twitter account now for a number of years.
Yes.
And your tweets play a role in the book. You know, you have these tweets that are well-known and well-parodied because everyone's like, oh my God, she cannot live this perfect, fabulous life all the time. But tell me about how that sort of engagement with social media has sort of worked its way into the writing of the book.
Well, Twitter was, in my kitchen year, Twitter was incredibly important. I mean, I have always felt alone in the kitchen. And one of the things I loved best about Gourmet was, you know, those 8 connected test kitchens. And you would go in there and there would be 10 passionate cooks arguing about every recipe, talking about it. How do you make this better? And the first time, you know, after we moved up to the country in a very bad winter, and we got snowbound a lot. So there would be whole days when we were really stuck alone up in that cold winter. And the one way I had of being connected to the world was my phone, my iPhone still worked, and I could still tweet to people. And I had just baked needed a loaf of bread when the power went out. And I was like, and I tweeted, what can I do with this dough? It could be days before I get power again. And people started tweeting back at me, just keep punching it down, just keep punching it down. And I did for 3 days. And at the end of it, it was the best bread I've ever baked in my life. But it was the Twitter community who I suddenly felt like I'm not alone in my kitchen.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ruth.
This was great. Thank you.
Ruth Reichel is author of My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Changed My Life. Frances Lam is editor-at-large at Clarkson Potter and a monthly Eat columnist at the New York Times Magazine. Ruth left us with some recipes. You can find her recipe for deviled chicken and her apple crisp at splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern have been writing about local eating since the 1970s, starting with their first book, Road Food. Now, with more than 30 books between them and a website, roadfood.com, they keep us all up to date on what and where to eat in America. They check in with Lynn here on a regular basis.
Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So what's the latest?
We have been in the Idaho Panhandle, in Coeur d'Alene in particular, and we found a charming, truly charming little restaurant. I almost want to call it a precious little restaurant, but that makes it sound too precious. It's called the Garnet Cafe, named, in fact, for Idaho's state gemstone, the garnet.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. It's a precious place. And what's great about the garnet is that it is a true and honest example of real farm-to-table cooking without a lot of pretense about it. A lot of what you get at this restaurant is sourced directly from the family farm of the owners. That means bacon, sausage, ham all come from their pigs.
Mm-hmm. Justin and Angeline McLean are the farmers and the owners of the cafe.
It's the McLean family farm. And, you know, if you get yogurt with your meal, it comes from farm milk. Duck and chicken eggs come from farm poultry. Seafood, of course, they don't raise on the farm, but that's caught fresh from Pacific waters.
And they have mushroom collecting friends who bring them their mushrooms.
Yeah, so it's all like, you know, really just direct food the way you want it, prepared, I don't want to say really simply, because they have some really interesting preparations. For example, this is a restaurant where you can get breakfast, and some really interesting breakfast. I ordered salmon for breakfast, and what I got was a thick, heavy slab of Bristol Bay. That's, you know, Alaska, sockeye salmon.
Right.
And because it was for breakfast, it was topped with a kind of a marmalade glaze that was such a sweet halo for that kind of pink protein of the salmon.
Mm.
And what's interesting is the salmon was presented on some sautéed vegetables, and it had a pair of, like, farm eggs, homemade toast, and what came with the toast was what I thought was some kind of honey butter.
Right.
It turned out to be lemon curd for putting on the toast. What a great combo with the salmon.
Just a little touch.
Yeah.
Sounds wonderful.
And the great thing is you can't spend $20 on a meal here. It's like very inexpensive and just very direct and straightforward. And just
charming. We sat out on the patio and I mean, it was just lovely. I had what is absolutely phenomenal, but I have never seen in a restaurant for breakfast, which is eggs with a side of spaghetti.
Yeah.
And I know, I mean, you would probably think that sounds terrific.
I love that.
But it was beautiful spaghetti noodles with shreds of sun-dried tomato, roasted garlic, herbed goat cheese, Parmesan cheese and basil, and God, was that delicious.
It was a really nice place, and it was one of those places with a fairly long menu. We only ate there a couple of times, but there are so many things I want to go back for, like some of those pork products that come from the farm hogs. I really want to try that. Probably the most interesting thing on the menu, which we didn't try, and I'm not sure I will next time we go back, it's something that is listed on the menu as everyone's favorite.
Not mine.
What that is Spam and eggs.
And yet on the other end of the spectrum, for breakfast, they have duck confit.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That was good.
It's a little kind of all over the place, but everything
is. Do you remember the French toast that was stuffed with Nutella and banana? That was really good.
Fabulous.
Okay, so it's the
It's the Garnet Cafe. In Coeur d'Alene, in the Idaho Panhandle.
I don't think it's called the Panhandle in Idaho. It's like the smokestack or something.
Well, whatever, the top part of
Idaho. It's that skinny part of Idaho.
Yeah,
that goes way north.
Goes
way up. It's sort of the reverse panhandle.
This sounds like a real jewel.
A real fun place.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael's road food picks at splendidtable.org. Coming up, what recipes does Emeril Lagasse really find essential? Well, stay tuned. Lynn's away. I'm Sally Swift. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Sally Swift, in for Lynn Rosetto Casper. When you mention Emeril Lagasse, Kick It Up a Notch and Bam come to mind. those signature, somehow flavor-imbuing television moves that he perfected on his Food Network shows, Emerald Live and Essential Emerald. You also think Creole and Cajun, all those flavors of Louisiana. Well, it's ironic because Emerald grew up in Massachusetts. His first job was at 10 in a Portuguese bakery, which ultimately led him to turn down a full scholarship in percussion at the New England Conservatory of Music. Instead, it was straight to a culinary program at Johnston & Wales. He joins us today with his latest book, Essential Emerald. Emerald, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So we love to talk essential recipes here at the Splendid Table. We've done this whole series called Key 3, where we ask chefs and good cooks the three recipes that they think every cook should know. So I'm going to cut to the chase. What are your three?
Well, I would say probably number one would be pâté choux, to either make profiteroles or to make gougères. I think understanding that is important.
So it's an essential dough.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think a basic bread dough is also very important, whether it's something as simple as pizza or a basic white bread dough that you can proof and understand that I think is important. And then I would think probably the technique of making an emulsion. I think that people get a little freaked out about making an emulsion, and it's really just, as you know, really whisking it and doing it slow.
Like a salad dressing, a vinaigrette is an emulsion.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So I think those three stick with.
That's interesting. No one has mentioned those three before. It's a first for us. Now, the book contains more of your essentials, as you call them, and one of them that I found really, really interesting was the chow mein sandwich. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Fall River, Massachusetts, and this particular recipe was really a memory, as most of the book is, a memory of, my journey.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my journey was growing up on these chow mein sandwiches from a place called Me Sums, which is still there. And every time I visit Fall River, I have to go to Me Sums and get one of those chow mein sandwiches.
So it's literally chow mein that is in a hamburger bun? Is that?
In a hamburger bun. And they would wrap them in this wax paper,
mm-hmm.
and you would get them in a paper bag. And I can remember when they used to be 3 for $1, and you'd buy a bunch of them and take them home. And the more that you waited, the soggier that they got.
And the better, right?
Yeah. Me Sums.
Me Sums. I was surprised to see you dedicate this book to Charlie Trotter. Tell us about who he was for you.
Well, Charlie was not only one of my best friends, but he was one of my best pals to cook with, and we did a lot of cooking and a lot of traveling together. We really explored a lot of parts of the world together to learn, and one that's in the book is a journey that we had together when we went to see Freddy Giraudet in Crissier, Switzerland. Freddy Giraudet was a Swiss chef who had this restaurant in Crissier, Switzerland for many, many years. He ran the restaurant with his mom and a really incredible, talented maitre d'. And so many times Charlie and I and some friends would make the journey over there. So Charlie was not only, like I said, my best friend and, we did a lot of cooking together, but he was a brother. He was, as I say in the book, a passionate explorer. He was certainly a scholar. He was a perfectionist. He was near genius and ran an incredible restaurant in Chicago. I think that really put Chicago first kind of on the map for grand
mm-hmm.
cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And he's well missed.
You talk about a lot of your chef friends in this book. People who have influenced you, like Mario.
I mean, that's what Essential Emerald really is. It's not really a memoir, but it's sort of a journey, 30 years, the last 30 years, how it's evolved. I mean, I couldn't put everything in the book, and mm-hmm. I couldn't put everyone in the book. But there are people like Mario Batali, mm-hmm. who has sort of inspired me. There's a very unique pasta dish that I sort of did my version for him, Larry Forgione, who was certainly a chef that inspired me at a very young age, before I started at Commander's Palace back when he was at the River Cafe. He became a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
How old were you then, Emeril?
In my young 20s.
Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking about traveling with Charlie. Is there a food, a culinary trip that you haven't taken yet that you're excited to make?
I haven't spent a lot of time in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more the other side of the pond.
Mm-hmm.
So I've spent a lot of time, obviously, in France and Italy and Greece and Portugal and Spain. So, you know, my influences and my style, you know, which is a bit rustic, certainly bold, I think is because not only my heritage and growing up and how I was influenced at home, but certainly how I was schooled and where I studied and where I visit is more of those particular areas of the world. So it's more, you know, it's more the mortar for me. You know, I just had a trip to Greece, and I experienced some wonderful food there. I would like to go to Australia again. I think it's a pretty interesting part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly how food is. Like, I would never ever think, and I have some good friends that are Greek, and I really never really thought much about their cuisine and culture, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, I had a recent trip there, and I was blown away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was blown away how every island has a little bit different influence than the next, and the style and, you know, and the technique. I find it fascinating. But that's how I approach food. You know, I'm always very well open-minded. I believe that, you know, you should learn something every day or you're cheating yourself. And so that's how I sort of approach it. I'm, you know, as I'm getting older and things evolve, my style just continues to keep getting probably a little simpler because I'm more ingredient and soil driven than I am about stuff being cute on a plate, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Emeril Lagasse's book is Essential Emeril. He left us with that recipe for Fall River Chow Mein. Find it at splendidtable.org. There is nothing as trendy as an ingredient that no one has paid attention to since your great-great-grandmother made pancakes with it. One of these forgotten foods is buckwheat, which is now on the fast track for curious cooks and chefs all over the world. One of those chefs is Sean Brock, a man devoted to saving traditional Southern ingredients. He brings those ingredients to life in his award-winning restaurant Husk in Charleston and in Nashville. And in Lynn's opinion, there is no one better to talk to about heritage ingredients.
Sean, it's good to have you back with us.
Oh, it's great to be here speaking with you.
So, buckwheat. I never think of this as a Southern ingredient. I mean, you have corn and you have rice, but I just never think of buckwheat. But is it a Southern ingredient?
Well, I think its role in the what we call the Carolina Rice Kitchen kind of qualifies it as a Southern ingredient because you have to think about agriculture in the 19th century and the 18th century. This was long before you could go and purchase, you know, industrial means of fertilizers or pesticides.
Right.
You had to understand crop rotation. You had to plant specific plants in a specific order to add or take away specific things from the soil to keep your main crop happy. And that crop here was Carolina gold rice. And buckwheat is really one of the more important ones when you're talking about crop rotations. And, you know, what's fascinating to me is when you're studying a cuisine, all of a sudden you find yourself studying agricultural practices because those plants that because those plants that were part of that crop rotation, they found their way into the pantry, into the kitchen, into the cuisine. And you can go to almost any farm in the South right now, and you'll see people using it as a cover crop or what they call green manure, and it's a really fantastic plant for that. But also in the kitchen, I think it's a really wonderful ingredient because it's one of those untapped ingredients because people I think it may have a bad rap because it's so healthy for you. You know how sometimes, like,
oh,
when
yeah,
something's
yeah.
extremely good for you, people think that it doesn't taste good. But once you eat buckwheat, there's this new flavor. You know, it's got this deep mineral bitterness, and it's really one of the most earthy ingredients you could ever imagine. We use it when we want to add earthiness to a dish, but we also really enjoy using it in desserts. I think it plays really well in the sweet world.
How do you use it in dessert? Because I think of buckwheat more as a savory ingredient, you know, buckwheat flour, buckwheat groats, the whole buckwheat. But how do you use it in desserts?
There's a really neat thing that you can do. You can take the groats and you soak them for a couple days, and then you rinse them a couple times, and then you just process them in a food processor, and you get this porridge, this raw, uncooked, incredibly delicious porridge that you can then sweeten. We'll sweeten it with sorghum, and then
another local ingredient, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then we'll take whatever fresh fruit that's ripe and delicious, and then we'll just put some ice cream with it. So you have this beautiful, earthy porridge, this fresh fruit and the ice cream, and it's quite simple dessert, but extremely delicious. And it always throws people for a loop because they don't expect to be eating buckwheat for dessert.
Interesting. So it's fermenting during that process.
Yeah, a little bit. And that gives it what we call a funky flavor. But it's really this depth of flavor that you can only get through fermentation, and which, you know, is all the rage these days. Everyone's talking about fermentation. Everybody's got little things fermenting all over their kitchen, which is fantastic because I grew up that way. And, you know, I grew up, my grandmother's basement was just full of these old crocks with corn on the cob fermenting and cabbage fermenting and all these things. And now it's the trend, and it's like the biggest trend. And it's fantastic because, to me, it's really one of the most delicious things that you could cook.
You're moving backwards at a fabulous rate. I think it's so exciting. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Sean Brock is author of Heritage. Get a little buckwheat in your kitchen with this recipe, spicy soba noodles with wilted watercress, from Laura Russell's book Brassica. Find it at splendidtable.org. World-class chef Lydia Bastianich wears a lot of hats. She's a restaurateur, a television host, author, and now she can add cooking for not one, but two popes to her CV. Lydia spoke with our producer Jennifer Russell about cooking for Pope Francis during his recent visit to New York City.
Lydia, it's lovely to have you back.
My pleasure, Jennifer, to be on the Splendid Table.
So this is not the first time you've cooked for a pope. But what was it like to cook for Pope Francis?
Well, cooking for him was extraordinary. And yes, I cooked for Pope Benedict, and that was in itself extraordinary. But there was something this time, you know, I adored this man. I think that in the planning before, when they told me that we would be cooking for His Holiness, oh, my God, you know, we set up the team. It was Angelo Vivolo, my daughter Tania Manuali, the chef at Salidia, Fortunato Nicotra. So we sat down and we said, okay, what are we going to cook? And, of course, big pieces of meat came to mind. He's from Argentina, and we were nervous about it and how we're going to do it. But as we got closer, Jennifer, you know, kind of an uneasiness, a peacefulness came about. First, he did not want meat or anything big. He wanted very simple. He wanted light fare. And so we stayed light.
Mm-hmm. I think cooking for someone can be really personal, like giving somebody a gift. So what inspired you as you were planning his menus?
Well, I think, you know, we followed his needs. And then we decided we are going to, of course, cook Italian, the food that we know best. He is Italian. He is from Piemonte. He loves rice. He loves squash. He loves beets. And so, first of all, I made him a big pot full of capon stock. You know, when you travel, soup is restorative. You're right, you know, when you cook for somebody, you give of your love, you give your sentiments. You want to take care of this person. At least that's how I feel. So some soup was surely due, but we wanted to elaborate a little bit and give him some of the local fare. Being on the East Coast, we got some Maine lobster. So a great appetizer of lobster caprese with burrata, tomatoes in season. You know, I went into my garden, and my mother, who's 96, we harvested we saved actually for him some of the best vegetables. We had beets, we had Swiss chard, tomatoes, squash. And for the table, we made the risotto. We enriched it with porcini mushrooms and truffles. For him, white risotto, riso in bianco. And what that means is with oil, with a little bit of onions, and lots of grana padano cheese. And he ate a nice bowl full of that. And, you know, kind of you get gratified when you cook for somebody and then you see the place come back empty.
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah. Friday, we stayed all with fish. We made tutto tonno, three ways, over tonnato sauce. But for him, we did grilled tuna with a little bit of sauce, and he loved it. For the main course, Long Island striped. We had some fishermen, you know, catch fresh. They brought them in the night before, and we roasted the whole striped with a little bit of olive oil, lemon juice, a little bit of parsley, and he enjoyed that as well. And do you want to know dessert, too?
Absolutely.
Okay. For dessert, we made angel food cake, nice and light, and I think was kind of a little fun there. Concord grapes are in season, Concord grape sorbet. So it was very easy, very light. He loved it. And for the other dinner, for dessert, I made an open apple tart. And he scooped all the apples out with the spoon. He just took a little bite of the crust, even though it was delicious, because he was watching.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Lydia, it all sounds delicious, and I love that you sourced some of the food from your garden.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the ultimate. In the Vatican, they have their own garden. They have their own chickens, their own eggs. So I wasn't going to be outdone. I want it for my own garden.
I love that. Well, you know, I read you were actually cooking in the townhouse where Pope Francis stayed. And I have the notion of you cooking in a sterile kitchen somewhere and bringing all the food in. And it wasn't like that at all, was it?
No, Jennifer. Actually, you know, I'm basically at heart, I'm a home cook, cooking for the family, for the table. And so being in the townhouse, that makes a big, big difference because it's like being in a family. You know, he was there. He was in the surroundings. You know, Jennifer, that on Friday, mm-hmm. we had lunch, and we served lunch, that is, and he went to rest for a few minutes. And then all of a sudden, the Secret Service man ran into the kitchen and says, the Pope is coming. Oh, my God. Don't you think that the Pope walked in the kitchen? And he said, may I have coffee with you? Posso prendere un caffè? And, I mean, we were all stunned, but it was so beautiful. He had his coffee, and he talked to us individually, you know, about us, about our lives. And it was, you know, it was just celestial, if you will. We were out of bounds there, in a sense.
Wow, what a moment. So, Lydia, what did this whole experience mean to you?
I felt very moved by His Holiness, you know, his presence and all, but also I felt very much part of what he was saying. I was an immigrant, a part of Italy that became Yugoslavia. We escaped back in Italy from there, communist Yugoslavia. And then we moved down to the States, and it was the Catholic Relief Services that brought us to the United States and helped us find a home that fed us. So I related very much in many different ways in what he was saying.
Mm, and food can bring us all together.
Food is the common denominator to all. You know, we have our differences, but we all sit at the table. We all need to feed. And, you know, to use that as a venue to feed each other, to show love to each other, to show understanding for each other, I think would be the ultimate. Food is the simplest conduit that we can all use to do that.
Absolutely. Lydia, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Celebrity chef Lydia Bastianich will be on tour with her new book, Lydia's Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine, this fall. To find out where she'll be, check out our website, lydiasitaly.com. But head to our website to find that recipe for heirloom tomato, house-made burrata, steamed Maine lobster. Sorry, Lydia's tomatoes are not included. But check out the entire papal menu, you know where, splendidtable.org. Coming up, it's you. Lynn tackles your questions. I'm Sally Swift, in for Lynn Rosetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Sally Swift. Lynn is away, but there's no way she'd miss out talking with you. She came in a bit earlier to take some of your calls.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It's time for us to connect. You can reach us at Twitter, Facebook, email us, that's splendidtable.org, or you can actually call 800-537-5252. Jess is calling from Essex Junction, Vermont. Jess, where exactly is Essex Junction?
Essex Junction is pretty close to Burlington. It's just about a 10 or 15 minute drive.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've spent some time in Burlington, which I just fell in love with. There's a Chinese restaurant there I would go back to in a hot minute for their mushrooms. But that's a whole aside, complete aside. You had a question, perhaps.
Yes. Much to several people's amazement, we have a pear tree that just flourishes every other year. And it's Bartlett, which means that they sort of need to be taken off the tree to ripen properly,
right.
And when we get them, it's an abundance of pears, and we just don't know how to keep up with them. And I have a little kid, so we've made some pear sauce, but I'm looking for other ways of keeping it, especially in any ways of keeping pears that will preserve them, but ideally not too sugary, and that would make that we can eat year-round.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. Well, a very adult treatment of those pears would be to slice them in wedges and tuck them into an attractive jar and cover them with brandy or rum or anything you want to cover them with that's alcohol, because it's a great preservative. And if you wish, add a little sugar to that, not a lot, but just a little, and a couple of split vanilla beans. Or instead of the vanilla beans, you could do cardamom and cinnamon sticks or clove. I think you get the idea of what I'm saying, that you flavor the whole thing, and it's very easy to do. Now, that's very adult, and that's the kind of thing you would put out next to something like a piece of ham or spicy vegetable sauté, or you could have it with ice cream or with cake or that kind of thing in the winter. The other thing, I'm just trying to think – one of the things you could try doing, I haven't frozen this, but it might work. I do it with bosque. Bosque is that drier pear, usually a brown pear. But it might work with Bartlett. I would put them in – I would, again, cut them into thin wedges. I would say figure 8 wedges per pear, 6 to 8 wedges per pear. Core them. You could leave the skin on. And what I would do is I'd spread them – on a big shallow pan, and I'd sprinkle them with a little bit of sugar, salt, fresh thyme, rosemary, and a little bit of olive oil on each one. And then I'd roast it at about 200 degrees. And what's going to happen is they're not going to dry completely, but they're going to lose a lot of their moisture and become very intense in flavor. And they're a fabulous side dish. I mean, they're much more something that would go with the main part of the meal rather than dessert. Now, you could do a dessert version of that with a little bit of honey and whatever spice you'd like. But the idea is you're roasting it very, 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 very slowly so that the pears are losing their moisture and their natural sugars are intensifying. Now, I've kept that in the refrigerator for probably 2 weeks, but I think it might be worth trying to freeze it.
Wow, that's exactly what I was looking for. Some way of making a side dish of pears.
Yeah. Now, if they end up being soggy when you defrost them, what I would do is puree them and blend them with roasted sweet potatoes.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, that would just be so good.
Oh, wonderful.
Now, once you've got that technique, you could do a lot of different things with it. You could do, believe it or not, with those pears, soy, a little sriracha, some lime or vinegar. Rice vinegar is fabulous, but you could use any vinegar, right? A little bit of oil, And then if you wanted to, grated ginger. You see, now we're going into Asia.
Yeah.
You follow me? And perfect. Then, you know, think about Morocco, sweet paprika, cinnamon, cumin, coriander, the ground coriander, lots of lovely orange rind, a little orange juice, and a little bit of olive oil. So now you got Morocco.
Wonderful.
So it's one. There are other things to do, but I think that might be really fun to play with.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. You are welcome. I wish that were my pear tree. Take care and enjoy the autumn in Vermont, Jess. It sounds fabulous.
I will. Okay. It is beautiful up here.
Okay, take care.
See ya. Bye-bye.
I have to say, Burlington is one of my very favorite towns. I was up there working with the local station, and I ate so well. And the countryside is fabulous. Beth wrote on Facebook that she's hosting a 50th birthday party, and she wants to have a champagne bar theme. And she's looking for good bubbles on the dry side for about $20, or less than $20. Well, here's a couple of thoughts for you. Made here in America. It's called Schramsberg is the company, and the champagne is Mirabelle. It's a beautiful rosé, dry but with a lovely amount of fruit and a little bit of yeast. It's really delicious. Now, I have to say, I find it at Costco, and it's about $19.99 a bottle. It may be more money elsewhere. But for $15 a bottle, generally, there is, believe it or not, a bubbly wine from New Mexico called Gruet, G-R-U-E-T. It is delicious. It is dry, and I think it would be perfect to add to the champagne bar. I mean, very few people connect champagne with New Mexico. Then there's Domaine San Michel from Washington State. That's about $14 a bottle. And the San Michel people just make lovely wines, and they're really reasonable. And this is one of those wines that has, again, a sense of melaniness and yet some citrus, and it's dry. It's just delicious. And then finally, the Mum people from France have invaded the Napa Valley, and they make Mum Napa Brut Prestige. And this is quite dry as well. It has a lot of body, and it's very reasonable. So there's some thoughts, and happy 50th birthday. And you can call us, 800-537-5252. We have Srata calling from Bainbridge Island in Washington. I'm already dreaming of what it's like out there. Srata, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Well, thanks for taking my call in. I'm such a fan.
Oh, thank you.
I like collecting recipes. I mean, I read them, and then I love trying out new things. And I often come across the recipe calls for fish sauce.
Oh.
Now, we're vegetarian, and most, you know, a lot of these recipes, everything else in the recipe is a vegetarian type
That's right.
Thing, but then they throw in this fish sauce. And
I'm trying to think.
And so I was wondering if there was something that we could substitute.
In the back of my brain, there was something I read about this same situation. You're a vegetarian, and obviously fish sauce isn't going to work. And fish sauce is fermented small fish. It can be anchovies. Sometimes it's shrimp. But, you know, that's where it comes from. And
right.
I'm trying to think. I can't recall the details, but you may find something online. But what occurs to me is, you know, fish sauce has a very funky aroma, but it's loaded with umami, and it seems to lift everything it touches. And very small amounts of it just open up flavors. Well, although it's a different taste, but it's fermented, what I'm about to mention, and easy to get, and it does lift other tastes in small quantities, and that's soy sauce. But you need some funk, and I'm trying to figure out, you know what occurs to me? a mixture of soy sauce and sauerkraut juice. Now, sauerkraut juice is not what you find on every shelf in every market.
No.
No. But, you know, sauerkraut juice is salty, but it can have a funkiness because, again, fermentation has happened. And lactic acid has been released, and you get this quality. You know, miso, you know, it's fermented.
Right.
But I'd use a small amount with soy. I think that might work.
Okay, I will give that a try.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Now, of course, I'm going to hit the books as soon as I can and go online. But thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for taking my call. Bye-bye.
Take care. 800-537-5252. Jonathan's calling from Cologne, Germany. Oh, Jonathan, you're in one of my favorite cities.
Oh, that's great. Hi, Lynn. When I was in high school, I spent a year in the States, and I still have a lot of friends from back then. And one of them moved to Austin, Texas a while back, and he sent me a big package full of dried chilies. And I have so many of them. I already ground some of them into a chili powder and made some chili with it. But still have a few pounds of them to go through, so I was wondering if you could point me in a good direction.
Oh, sure.
What to do with the rest of them.
Do you know what kind of chilies they are, or is it a variety of chilies?
Yeah. I have arbol, guajillo, mulatto pods, ancho pods, and New Mexico pods and chipotle as well.
Oh, you have the whole range. I mean, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're very different.
Do you like Mexican cooking?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. If you go online, one of the great sources for recipes is a man named Rick Bayless, B-A-Y-L-I-S-S. Mm-hmm. And you'll find how to combine some of those chilies. For instance, the arbol tends to be spicier. The guajillo and the ancho can sometimes be almost velvety and a hint of sweetness, even though they have heat. And you can use them the way you would use an herb, the way you would use, you know, different flavored ingredients, because they have these different shadings. One thing that I like to do with I do what you do. I take the dried pods and I grind them up in my blender. And I have chili powder. And if I want them on the mild side, I empty out the seeds first. If I want to go for broke, I put the seeds in and grind them together. But one of the things you can do, even without grinding them, is that when you're making a soup or a stew, when you're cooking any form of beans, green beans, you know, like anything that's a vegetable mixture that's cooked with moisture.
Yeah.
Throw the whole pods in, one or two. You'll get a very, you know, and they'll get bruised and they may break a bit. But the idea is let them cook in and they're going to give you a backdrop of flavor.
Okay.
The other thing is when you grind up something like the guajillo, I do a dressing with it of guajillo, lime, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of oregano, and then oil. And you put, it's really delicious. You put that over wedges of orange or a green salad that has really spicy greens, you know, like endive and chicory and that kind of thing. And it's it's a very different take. And the other thing I use that for is I marinate things in it. Pork is wonderful. Any form of chicken and poultry. Game is fabulous in it. And then cook it however you want to. So that's another approach. One of the great things I like to do is I mix the ground guajillo or the arbol or anything else of those that you want, grind that up, and mix it with sugar and salt. And then take a really firm mango. You don't want it to be super ripe, okay? Mm-hmm. Peel the mango, cut it into sticks, and then just put it into a cup so that they're just sticking out and sprinkle it with the mixture of the chili, the salt, and the sugar. So it's sweet, it's salty, and it's hot. And that combination of the chili, the salt, and the sugar on potatoes, on pasta, on rice, on meat, it's wonderful. It's just delicious. And on fruit. I put it on peaches and, you know, anything that doesn't move too fast through the kitchen. So
thanks
that's
for the idea.
Yeah, I think that'll get you started.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, just keep them dry and away from light, and they're going to last a very long time.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, let air circulate around them, too.
I will.
You are a very lucky man. And thanks for the call, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Take care.
Lynn will be back next week. Remember, you can get to us anytime, Facebook, Twitter, or Go Retro, 800-537-5252. I'm Sally Swift. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Garrison Keillor. He said, "The highlight of my childhood was making my brother laugh so hard that food came out his nose." SplendidTable.org has just about everything you'll ever need. Recipes, newsletters, giveaways, and extended versions of interviews, like our contributor Melissa Clark's conversation with Marcus Samuelson. It's all about what's happening in the food scene in Harlem. Have a listen. And be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Lynn is back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Sally Swift, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.